Before we start today's episode, we're asking for your help. National Public Safety Telecommunicators Week is coming up in April, and we want to recognize the dispatchers and call takers who make a difference behind the scenes. If you're a first responder and a dispatcher ever had your back on a tough call or went above and beyond, send us a 30 to 90 second voice note telling us that story. Please email it to amelia@tosopod.com by March 31st. That's AMELIA@TOSOPOD.com. Help us recognize the people behind the headsets. All right, let's get into today's conversation.
My friend Carl, our stories are intertwined through our fire service. Him and I were sitting on that rock trying to keep some kind of contact with this person, and both of us said, like, if this doesn't go well, this is my last call.
Welcome back to The Other Side of the Call. Today, we're heading north, way north, up to Fort Smith, Northwest Territories. It's a remote, tight-knit community of just over 2,200 people, and frankly, one of the most beautiful but unforgiving places you can live in Canada. My guests today are Captain Jason Panter and his wife, Mrs. Helen Panter. Jason is a long-serving member of the Fort Smith Volunteer Fire Department with more than 20 years of service. He and Helen balance full-time careers while raising kids in a place where community is everything and resilience looks different than it does down south. Jason and I actually know one another because, believe it or not, I used to live up in Fort Smith, albeit briefly. This was in the mid-90s, before either of us really knew anything about dispatch consoles, fire halls, or trauma. If memory serves, Jason arrived in town about a week after I did, and before anyone asks the inevitable question, yes, it was very cold up there. Seriously, I remember mornings about flesh freezing in under 60 seconds. Anyhow, today's conversation is about what fire service looks like in isolation, what families carry in a remote northern town, and what it means to serve when resources are thin and relationships are the backbone of the community. How does life unfold north of what most Canadians would call normal? Jason and Helen, thank you both so much for joining us today. Before we begin, a quick content warning. This conversation includes discussion of emergency calls in a remote northern community. Some descriptions may involve fires, injuries, and incidents affecting people our guests personally know. While nothing graphic is shared, the themes may still be distressing for some listeners, especially those with lived experience in first response, small town tragedies, or volunteer service. Please take care while listening and step away if you need a moment. Okay, so for people who've never lived in a northern town, what is one everyday thing that would absolutely blow someone's mind down here? Something that's completely normal to you guys, but feels wild to anyone from down south. Like personally, I remember the two taxi drivers in town would leave their cars running all night in the winter. Otherwise, they simply wouldn't start again, even with block heaters.
Distances is one of the big ones. People just don't grasp the scale and the distance. The next town for us is 3 hours away. Edmonton's our starting point if we're going out on a trip. That's 1,300 kilometers. So it's a we used to take off and do it in a day. Now with the kids, we try and split it into two to make it just to Edmonton before flying out anywhere. Mm-hmm. We're lucky to be on an all season road. So cost of living is not too bad. But other flyout communities are crazy expensive, but there's a winter road down Fort Chipewyan and then into Fort McMurray. So that cuts off about 400 kilometers in the trip to Edmonton. You're driving a lot slower through some of it, but it's neat to drive a different route.
So Helen, you are French. Where are you from originally?
Yeah, so I grew up in central Quebec in a small little town called L'Avenir, which means the future in English. So I always say I'm a futurist.
I love it.
L'Avenir is smaller than Fort Smith even, but it's like in between Montreal and Quebec City. So it's a cute little town in eastern township, central Quebec. So,
describe life in Fort Smith, the location, the climate extremes, the population. What's life like north of normal?
Well, we're as far south in the Northwest Territories as you can be. We're right on the Alberta border. It's located in Treaty 8 territory, so it's the traditional homelands of the Salt River First Nation. I can never say this one, Tibeti-Dinsilane Nation, formerly the Smith's Landing First Nation, and then the Métis people of Fort Smith as well. So, several Indigenous groups. The town's kind of a mix of pretty much half and half of Indigenous people and people from the south. Our golf course, our ski club, the rapids we go kayaking are all actually on the Alberta side of the border, which made for some interesting times during COVID, where we actually had a check stop at the border. We're on the banks of the Slave River, so it's really kind of historically important as part of the portage route to pass around the four sets of rapids around here. And those rapids are the only non-navigable section between the Arctic Ocean and the Mackenzie River, Great Slave Lake, and then into like Alberta and BC to the Peace and Athabasca Rivers. So really kind of a traditional area. There's a lot of history. It's been a well-traveled area through the years. It's not far enough north here to get true midnight sun, but around the summer solstice in June, the sun sets around 10, but doesn't really get dark. And then it's back up by 3 or 4 in the morning. Mm-hmm. Our paddling club does a midnight paddle on solstice, something along this day. So yeah, to be out in a river in a raft or a kayak in the midnight sun is pretty cool.
Could you guys each briefly explain how you ended up in Fort Smith?
When I finished university, I needed to go on an adventure, and I needed something new. So I applied to become a French assistant through a Government of Canada program. And then many interviews later, I got accepted. Maybe I should go somewhere else where maybe not a lot of people know about or are interested. And at the time I applied, there was 2 spots left in Fort Smith and Inuvik NWT. So in my head, I was like, well, I'll start at the south of the NWT. And if I really like it, maybe I'll move more north. And then that's what brought me to Fort Smith in 2007. Mm-hmm. I came for 9 months and 18 years
you're
later,
still there.
And I think that's the story of a lot of people that were not born in Fort Smith. Mm-hmm. You come for to check it out sometime for a few months. And I always say, if in the 3 first months, you're liking the place, you're never going to live. Mm-hmm. And if you're like, I'm not sure, then most likely you may not stay as long. But yeah, that's what brought me. I've been at Parks Canada since 2009.
Wow. And Jay, how about you?
So, looking for a bit of adventure, but 50 cents an hour, I say, is what brought me to Fort Smith. So after I finished my degree, I was working in Edmonton, and it was a job. It was okay, but I didn't love it. The employer from up here called again and said, hey, I'm looking for a tech. Are you still interested in coming north? And I'm like, well, what's the offer? And at first I was going to see if I could, get a better offer and use that as leverage to get a raise down south. So, but, it's still in my head that, maybe this will work. And he offered me $1 an hour more than I was making in Edmonton. I'm like, so I took that to my boss there and he offered me 50 cents more. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to give this a try up north. So I figured I'd come up and check it out for a year. That was June of 95. So I crossed over 30 years this year.
Wow, yeah.
It was 4 years with the private employer before getting on with the government.
And how did firefighting come into play and the volunteer firefighter?
Seeing it, a small town, you're seeing the calls, you're seeing the trucks rolling out, friend group, right away got into a good group of friends and some of them were involved with the department. My roommate for a while, kind of seeing what he went through as a rookie coming in, and it was, I would not say hazing, but it was fun. It was good stuff. It was in good humor. It was nothing mean and stuff. It was a good sport. It's like, this looks interesting. And then just, out with friends on a Friday night, and I've been talking about, maybe I'm thinking about it and whatnot. But early Saturday morning, the doorbell rang and I answered the door, and it was one of my buddies that handed me an application for him and said, here, fill this out before you change your mind.
Oh, they knew what they wanted.
I signed up on Monday.
That's awesome. Now, what is the time commitment for somebody who, you're talking to a lot of people down south of the border here, who maybe have never even heard of volunteer firefighting. If they live in a city, it's just like, what? What do you mean people volunteer to do this and put their lives at risk? What? So how many hours would you say a week or a month or a year does this take away from the family or require of you?
It's grown, definitely. The training demands have really grown. Like when I first joined, and we practices where every, 2 or 3 weeks a month, we'd have an evening practice. Now it's, four practices, and then there's often some extra stuff going on. If we're involved in a training program, then there'll be some weekends involved, or if we've got new members coming on, then some of the senior members will be brought in on a weekend or another evening to help out. We have our officers group meeting a couple times a month, or every couple months as well too, to plan training and get things set up. When I started, it was just a volunteer chief as well, that had, you know, some additional roles. They put in a couple extra hours, and you know, through the years that's evolved to, we've got a full-time paid position as the chief. That's was great for a year or two, but then the town kind of kept pulling him into more and more. So now they're director of corrective services and cover a whole lot of areas. And so then the stuff that we wanted a paid chief for is now falling back to the volunteer deputies and whatnot. But it's definitely growing. But our training, you know, we're also training to a lot higher standard too. And since we've become a combined fire EMS department in recent years too, there's a lot more training as well from the EMS side of things.
So you had already done that and signed up before you met Helen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Many, many years. I was on the department for better part of 9 years at least before we even met. Close to 10 years before we were dating. We had done audio clips of everybody of, you know, why did you join the fire department and whatnot? And everybody kind of had the same stories. Like, you know, I wanted to give back to this community. This community's embraced me, so I want to do something to help out to the community. That's what got me in the door. But then once I'm in, yeah, that camaraderie what that kind of fire family becomes, especially to a lot of us that are away from our families. And it's really close bonds that build up through that. And of course, then everybody said, you know, and to get to ride on the big red trucks.
So. Yeah, which is always cool.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about the training load and the practices and stuff, but like in a town of 2,200 people, not outside of fire season, like forest fire season, what's the sort of frequency of calls? How often does that pager go off?
It's all over the place. We've had, you know, months where it's, you know, rang once and it was a wrong number or something like that. But then we'll have a week where we'll have three working structure fires.
Wow.
So it's been up and down, you know, definitely peaks and valleys. It's been a lot more steady in recent years. Again, since we became a combined fire EMS department, the EMS volume is really high. Just the nature of the world these days, and you know the drug epidemic that's sweeping everywhere. So overdoses and things like that.
Oh, that's sad.
Up here, but yeah, there's lots. So you know it's a mix of you know those kind of substance related calls and everything that goes along with that, as well as mental health, but also you know life in the north. People are on quads and snow machines and working chainsaws and out in the bush and doing stuff like that.
So you guys are getting called to things outside of just fire-related issues when you're volunteering as a firefighter.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We talk about firefighting, but you have to have many different hats and maybe even have skills related to those calls you're going to, right? If you're going to a mental health call, you're going to a, you know, drug episode call, any of these things, you need to be prepared for what you're going to be seeing when normally you're trained to just be focused on putting out the fire. That's got to be stressful sometimes.
Sorry. Well, and I see that's kind of been my personal experience because I had been quite a long-term fire member that when we became the combined department a number of years ago, they kind of went to, you know, any of us that had been around for 10 years or more. And it was said, you know, this is it. You weren't on the volunteer EMS department before. Do you want to be part of that now? And a couple of us, myself included, said, no, I'm okay with the fire side. I don't want to be dealing with that stuff and what goes along with it. So I was able to set that boundary. And we still train to it and we mix our practices, our mix of fire practices or EMS practices. So you know, still train to the same or to the baseline first responder level of medical side of things.
Like I think that's a very important thing, even if you're an employee, but also very much so as a volunteer, to have that boundary on what you want to expose yourself to. Mm-hmm. You know, boundaries are so important. And when you're first getting into something like this, you might be maybe like unintentionally ignoring the need for those boundaries because you're just excited and you want to be in there and you want to be with your, you know, with all the other guys on the scene. And, you know, you don't necessarily think, oh, I don't know if I want to be exposed to these things. Right. There might be some pressure even to just do it all.
Definitely is. And that's, you know, that's part of the obligation of anybody new coming in is you're doing both. Like you're not choosing one or the other. You're doing both for anybody new coming in.
Helen, had you ever been exposed to or involved with a family member or friend who was a volunteer firefighter? Like, did it give you any pause when you're falling in love with and marrying Jason that you're signing up for this support role?
Well, I've never had my family. There's nobody that are firefighters. Which is a funny thing about Jason being a firefighter. That's when I saw him for the first time for the firefighter ball, actually. He was with somebody else at the time, but then he cut my eyes. I was like, ooh, oh, that's a nice guy in a suit. I was like, I like him. And then eventually that's how we kind of met and kind of got together as well after he left his girlfriend. But... you know, I always knew Jason as a firefighter, and the community of like the guys and the gals and the fire community here are just like, it's like the other family. We have many, we have the work family, the community family, and the firefighter family, and everybody knows everybody. And I think sometime on Wednesdays, it's regular fire practice on Wednesdays, and some Wednesday he doesn't go to fire practice, and I'm like, what are you doing? Just go. This is your Wednesday to go. You know, and our routine with the kids sometimes is different. And then I was like, just go find your firefighter friends and spend time with them. Wednesdays is your firefighter time. Just go meet them. But then at the same time, I know that through years of experience and like it's a trust as well, because I know he has a lot of knowledge and I know that he's a good teacher too, to train the new firefighters as well. And when the pager, the radio rings and I know he's going, and I always say, okay, go save the world. You know? And when he comes back, he's always like the le monde est secure. So the world is safe when he comes back. But over years, there were time where he was gone for an extended time. And then eventually I was like, okay, he's not back. What's going on? And often like he will send me a text and say, okay, we're here for longer. Or it had happened once where he was gone all night. And eventually it was a big, big fire many, many years back where all the wives gathered together and then we made sandwiches or prepared snack for to bring to the firefighters, because we knew that was a long fire they had to fight. So at the same time, the boys have their firefighter community, but the wives, we have like,
you have your own, we have our sisterhood
where we reach to one another if need.
Okay, I have a kind of a dumb question as somebody from the city who only sees firefighters down here, but do you have fire hydrants, or do you just use pumpers, or do you get water from the lake? Like, how do you do this in the middle of nowhere?
No, most of the town itself is on a hydrant system. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple outlying kind of parts of the town that doesn't. So then we would be water tankers and portable tanks and water tankers for our pumpers to work. We've got the same kind of standard level pumpers that any city department would have for engines, as most would call them, that are a 5,000 liter tank, or sorry, liter gallon. If we're running multiple lines on a rural fire where we don't have a water supply yet, the pumper can push empty that tank in like 2 minutes. So getting water supplies is a really critical one for us, and you know, rationing water until we have the porta tank up, until the town's got two water trucks. There's lots of contractors with water trucks, so getting those all mobilized to be running on a working fire out of the hydrant system is definitely some work.
Who coordinates that? You're on site, your pager goes off, fly out the door, you're off fighting a fire, you're captain. Like, who on the team is saying, somebody go get a contractor with a pumper truck? Like,
one of our members is one of the water truck drivers. If it's a big one, then we're, you know, you got one hand on the radio coordinating the event and the other hand on the cell phone talking to highways to get their water tankers going or stuff like that, or getting hold of the contractors, or, it's quite a mix. So,
we talked briefly before we started today about your boys. You guys have two kids. They're almost 9 and 11. Is there a point where you sit them down and explain what dad does? Do they understand what it is you're doing when the pager goes off and you run out the door in the middle of the night?
They're getting a better idea of it. We were kind of been asking them over the last week, like, what do you think when my pager goes off and I run out? And they're like, you're in a fire, you'll be back sometime. It's probably different for them. We see how all of our kids are spoiled. You know, all of us on the fire department with their kids are spoiled. Like, how many kids get to go hang out in the fire hall and ride around in the trucks on any given parade and stuff like that? But, you know, we've all got baby pictures of them in our boots and different things like that from through the years and stuff like that. So it's, it's been part of their life, their whole life, and since they, all through it. So they're getting an idea now that it's not always easy days. You know, we've had some major structure fires here over the last year. So if when I'm back at the hall packing up and send a text, hey, if you guys drive by with this street on your way to school this morning and you'll see what we were doing all night long kind of thing.
Wow.
They're seeing the burnt out houses and the stuff that we've been dealing with. So, they've got a pretty good idea, but I don't want to, introduce trouble to them.
They're too young for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. They've got their own experiences. You're asking about that picture in my background of the lake. It's my friend's cabin. 2020 COVID, we couldn't leave the territories. We flew out there for a week, had an amazing week of fishing and hiking and exploring. 2021, we tried to repeat that, going out on a float plane, and our landing didn't go well. We ended up upside down in the lake.
We ended up crashing. Yeah,
pilot hadn't lifted his wheels after he took off from the runway, and so when we went to land on floats on the water, it was flip, flip, skip.
And then we flip, and
the boys were with you.
Yeah, yes. I was in the front with the pilot, Talon, and the boys were in the tail. It was the tail otter.
Yeah,
how utterly terrifying. Mm.
Yeah.
So they've had their experiences with some of that kind of stuff, and we don't need to dance around much more with that.
But I think when I think about things with my therapeutic lens on with this, you've described that you were drawn to this volunteer, initiative because of the brotherhood and the community and things that you saw that looked appealing to you. And then your wife is sitting here sharing about, I have, the wives who support me when I'm worried about him out on a call, and we all get together whenever they're all fighting some big battle. And then the kids have each other as well. So like you're describing what we would call as like a very secure attachment. Mm-hmm. In some ways, some might call it trauma bonding. I don't know. but to me, it's like you have each other's backs, and then the wives have each other's backs, and then the kids have each other's backs. So like, even though there's no talking about it, your children always have this idea that there's someone there, that no matter I'm feeling inside, I know that these other kids maybe feel that way too, and I'm not alone, right?
Sounds like they're almost like cousins.
And And this is what small communities are. Like everybody knows everybody. This is our other family, our close family, and the friends and like the firefighters and the wives and the kids' friends. Like we're all together. We see each other almost daily, and we always have. We know that if we are in need or we need to talk to somebody, there's always somebody there to look at us or help us, or vice versa, we help them. And this is what happened after the plane crash. This is when the kids were young. Jace was 4, Jordan was 7. Yeah. And, it's a trauma. We have talked about it, and we went through our head and see what happened and how we dealt with the situation. And I always say, because of all our years of training, him, firefighters, me through Parks Canada, we were able to make the most of that situation in a positive way. What are our priorities? What do we have to do to make sure that everybody comes out safe? And that's what we did. And even though they were little, they knew what needed to be done. Just the same as we always practice, if something happened in the house and you need to exit, what are the steps?
Yeah, what are the easiest ways out?
Yeah, we both spend a lot of time in small planes.
When we were upside down, we were sitting at the top. Yeah. So many nights after, I had nightmare that they were bouncing everywhere. So our years of training came to play. I saw the water slowly coming, and I was like, I have time. What are my priorities? What do I do? So I took those 4 or 5 seconds my first thing was, get the kids out. If the plane is going underneath the water, then Jason and I may have more chances to find our way out. Mm-hmm. The kids, maybe not. Lucky for us, we had friends at the cabin. So they heard the plane, and they heard that big boom cannon, where they've never heard that sound before. And that's when they went around the point and they saw the plane upside down, and that's what, and then two, their training skill, like, okay, let's go, and we need to go help them out.
Did they have a boat? They came and got you, or?
Yeah.
Well, that's it for part one of our North of Normal series. Jason and Helen, thank you both so much for sharing your story and giving us a glimpse into life as a volunteer fire family in Fort Smith. Next week, we'll be back with part two, where we'll talk about wildfire season in the North, what happens when entire communities face evacuation, and how volunteer firefighters carry that responsibility when resources are limited. If today's episode resonated with you, please consider sharing it with someone who might benefit. You can also follow the show and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Amazon. And remember, if it keeps you here, let's talk about it. Now, here's Becca with a short grounding exercise.
Thank you for listening today. We invite you now to take a nice deep breath in through your nose. Hold it for 4 seconds and let it go. I'd like you to place your hands up on your chest, cross your arms. So I want your right hand on your left bicep, your left hand on your right bicep. And I want you to just start to do a nice light tap back and forth, almost like there's a butterfly resting on your chest. Just a nice tap, 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 tap. Still remembering to breathe in and hold, and then breathe out. Nice breaths in and out. This is a reminder that you are safe, your reality